Escape from Camp 14 is one of the most riveting books I've read in many years. It tells the story of Shin Dong-hyuk, who was born inside one of the prison camps of North Korea and escaped to freedom through China to South Korea and eventually to the U.S. My guest is Blaine Harden, the longtime reporter, newspaper journalist, who wrote Escape from Camp 14. Toward the end of our show, we'll also talk about Harden's book about the Columbia River, whose title is A River Lost. Welcome to After Deadline, Blaine.
Good to be here.
We'll talk about Shin's story, of course, but let's start at the point where you met him. How did that happen?
He was living in Seoul. I was living in Tokyo, writing about Northeast Asia for the Washington Post. I'd been sent there by my boss to try to tell him and the readers of the Washington Post a story about North Korea he hadn't heard before. So I'd been there for about a year, and I was struggling. It's very hard to tell a fresh story about North Korea because American correspondents can't go there. Or if they do, they go for only a few days and under strict supervision. So I heard from family friend who'd heard about Shin, and he was living in Seoul. He'd been there for about a year. He was running out of the government money that is given to North Korean defectors when they arrive in South Korea. He was worried that he might become homeless and have to go live in the train station. So I invited him to lunch, and at lunch he ate a lot. And he was incredibly wary, suspicious, and he had a look and a coldness in his eyes that I'd never seen in a human being. And I'd covered lots of terrible things in Africa and Eastern Europe as a reporter, but this guy was in a different category. And at that meal, very memorable lunch, he told me about watching his mother being hanged and how he was glad to see her die, that he hated her, and that she'd done him wrong in prison. And I'd never heard anybody tell a story like that before. So I wrote it up in the Washington Post, and it got very good play on the front page, and it got an enormous reaction from readers, not policy people, but human beings who read newspapers. And they sent Shin lots of money, prayers. I had a hard time dealing with all the stuff that they wanted to give him through the Washington Post. And so I went back to him, and I realized that his story was that key to unlock North Korea that I'd been sent out to find. So I said, let's do a book. If it works, if I can find a publisher, we'll split the money, but you have to tell me the truth about your lives, and it's going to take a while. And he said, no, I won't do it. I don't like you. I don't trust you. And so then I spent the better part of a year begging and getting human rights groups to persuade him that it would be good for him and good for his cause, which is to publicize the existence of these camps in North Korea and to put pressure on North Korea to close them. And finally, he agreed.
If you just joined us, this is After Deadline. My guest is Blaine Harden, author of Escape from Camp 14. Do you speak Korean?
No.
Okay.
So this was
a
problem. He speaks a bit of English now, quite a bit more English than he did when I first met him 4.5 years ago. So we did it all through translators in Seoul, translators in the suburbs of Los Angeles, and translators in Seattle. He ended up moving to Seattle for a while. And the key to the success of the book was finding brilliant translators who he trusted and whose command of idiomatic American English allowed me to really understand what he was talking about.
Uh-huh. It took you some time to learn that story. And as I read it in your book, this was a process of what we would call a battered person coming to terms with his own past, or we might, as Americans call it, the business of recovered memory. So that you got, as time went on, you got different versions of events over time.
The problem about Shin's story, of any of these survivors of the concentration camps in North Korea, is you can't check them as
sure.
a journalist. You can't go there and talk to the guards, talk to other prisoners, walk around. You just can't. And so it made me incredibly uncomfortable, especially since I invested almost 4 years of time in the book. So With Shin, there was a process of trying to verify what he said. And the way I did that was to compare what other camp survivors have said. He's the only person born in a camp to escape. He's in a category of one on this planet. But there are now 60, that's 60, other people who've been in the camps and who were released after a period of like 4 to 10 years in the camps, who then found their way out of North Korea through China to South Korea. I've interviewed about 6 or 7 of those people, but the 60 others have been interviewed very thoroughly by journalists, human rights workers, the South Korean government. And so what they have said about how the camps operate is very well known, very well documented, and it's available in hundreds and hundreds of volumes right now in Seoul. So basically, I found out how the camps work from all these other individuals. And it's at a level of veracity, of real good, solid social science about how the camps work. They all have worked exactly the same way for almost 50 years.
And one of the striking things you point out in there is that one of these camps is larger than Los Angeles.
They're very big.
Yeah.
They're kind of like work farms. And they're threaded through the mountains of central North Korea, usually quite a ways away, 50 or so miles away from any population center. And there's usually there's farms and factories. There's often a hydroelectric dam to power them. And they produce military uniforms, pottery, cement, pork, lots of stuff. Much of it goes to the military.
The essence of life in a North Korean gulag, as I get it through your book about Shin, is an incentive system that rewards snitching. Can we use that as a lens to tell his story?
Yeah. What's interesting and unique about him is that he grew up, he was bred in the camp, very much like a hog is bred on a farm in Iowa. His parents were chosen by the guard and instructed to have sex. After he was born, he lived with his mother for a while, but he was really raised by the guards with their value system, with their ethical structure. And that structure was, you are a sinner. The only way to overcome your sins, they use the kind of the language of Christianity, strangely enough, in a completely godless state. The only way to overcome your sins is to tell on other people. If you do that, then you'll mitigate your sin. You'll get more to eat. So he would snitch on his mom, on his dad, on his friends, on anybody. And he was a good, successful snitch. That's why he didn't die in the camp as a child. He snitched out his own mother and brother when he heard them talking about a plan to escape.
And they, of course, end up being executed.
Right.
As a result. If you just joined us, this is After Deadline. My guest is Blaine Harden, author of Escape from Camp 14. Well, Shin's escape from the camp and from North Korea and through China, as you report, is a succession of providential breaks that began when he crossed the camp's electrified fence. Recount for us, if we could please, the steps along the way of his escape that were rather amazing.
Well, the most important part of his escape was meeting someone who knew that there was a world outside the fence, which was a knowledge that he did not have. He didn't know until about 6 weeks before he went through that fence that the world was round. And he wanted to get through that fence because he met somebody who was raised in Pyongyang, the capital, and who'd traveled abroad in China, the former Soviet Union. And this individual, a man named Park, told Shin that if you got out and went to China, you could eat grilled meat and have the other delights of freedom. Shin was at this point about 23 years old, and he had been hungry his whole life. And the thought of being able to eat his fill, particularly of grilled meat, he started to dream about it and fantasize about it. And finally, he decided that life in the camp wasn't worth living, and he'd rather die than live there anymore. So he and Park planned an escape. The escape was to have been a two-part operation. Shin was the inside guy, getting Park and him to the fence and through the fence. And then Park, who'd actually lived outside the fence and who had told him that the world was round and that China was north, was to be his guide. They went to the fence at dusk on a cold January's morning in 2005. Shin was to have gone through first. This is an electrified fence, lethally electrified. But Shin fell on his face, slipped in the snow before he got to the fence. Park got there first, shoved his torso through the first two strands of the fence, and was electrocuted. And Shin crawled over his smoldering body outside into the snow and ran down a hill and was free, which was very good for him, except that he didn't have any idea where to go.
And so he, and then, as I remember it, the from your book, the next bit of luck he had was in crossing to China, across a river.
Well, the best bit of luck he had was that he found a change of clothes within a few hours. So he got out of his prison garb, which would have identified him immediately, and he changed into an old military uniform. North Korea is the most militarized country on the planet, and wearing an old military uniform and being dirty and skinny is a pretty familiar look in North Korea. So he then walked into a town, stole some food, and then managed to find some traders. North Korea is a police state, but it also has a very vibrant trading culture. That's how people get food, mostly. He fell in with some traders who were moving north towards the Chinese border, and he walked with them. That was his great good luck. Crossing the border at the time that he did it in 2005 was an incredibly routine thing. Hundreds of thousands of people crossed that border every year at that time. So he gave a guard a cookie and a cigarette and walked across the border with no trouble.
Well, let's go back to the moment when he meets this older man in the underground prison. And this is a fascinating thing, I think, you point out in the book, where it wasn't simply the geographical things he learned about, but there were concepts that he learned about, like empathy.
Growing up with his mother, who may or may not have wanted to be impregnated, and may or may not wanted to have taken care of him, he just didn't have any concept of trust or love, and his mother beat him with a shovel if he would eat her lunch, and he always ate her lunch if he could because he was so desperately hungry. When he found out that his mother and brother were planning an escape, he turned them in, and they were imprisoned in an underground prison inside this camp for an investigation. He was also put in there, and he was tortured to see what he really knew about the escape plan. He made it clear in that torture that he didn't know anything more than what he told him, so they allowed him to live. But he was also very severely burned by this torture. He'd been lowered over burning coals as part of the torture. In any case, they put him in a room with an older man who took care of him, who put salty soup on his burn wounds, which helped them to recover, and who fed him some of his food. No one had ever shown him kindness without asking something in return before. And it really helped set him up for a desire to get out of the camp later when he met somebody else who was kind to him, this man named Park. So he had two lucky breaks inside the prison. I often describe him as the luckiest unlucky boy in North Korea, because in the midst of just unutterable horror, he met two men who were kind and who gave him a clue of what it meant to be a human being. And, you know, he's been out now for about 6 years. He says he's still learning how to be a human being, but he got his first lessons in the worst possible circumstances.
The level of brutality that he describes and you record in the book is unfathomable. There's the story of a young girl who I think took 9 kernels of corn or something, and as a consequence was put in front of her class, and everyone was invited to come up and hit her, and they did until she was dead. There's a level of what appears to the casual reader of your book as a sadistic streak, which the camps nurture in their guards. Is that overstatement?
No, it's not overstated. The guards have complete license to be sadists. They can kill, rape with impunity. as part of their job description. I've talked to guards who've told me that. But the camps are not just a place to be mean. They serve an incredibly useful role for North Korea. They've been around since 1958. It's important to understand no dictatorship, no totalitarian system has lasted as long as North Korea. It lasted more than twice as long as the Soviet Union or Mao's China. And the camps are a very important reason why. What they do, they serve a very important function. They isolate and eliminate the few who have the temerity to speak ill of the Kim family dynasty that runs the country, and they scare the hell out of everybody else. Everybody knows these camps exist. Everybody knows if you step out of line, you will go there. And the system of punishment is such that if I were to say that Kim Jong-un, the current leader, is a fat, incompetent killer, if I were to say that, then I would go to the camp, my children would go to the camp, and my parents would go to the camp, and we would all be worked to death. The system works very well to keep people quiet.
North Korea is commonly called a communist country, but I've also read analysis that says the most correct way to view the Kim regime is that it's a crime family. It deals in kidnapping, counterfeiting, murder. Is that an acceptable
It is a crime family. It's a soprano state, and there are countless examples of that. Probably the best, most recent example is right now there are these scruffy free markets in the country. They came into existence in the 1990s when there was a famine and there was no food, and the markets existed to smuggle in food from China and sell it. People would trade lobsters and other things that they could find for food, and the markets now provide about 80% of the calories in the country. And it's also the most vibrant part of this very moribund economy. And the police know that. So the police prey upon the market traders. If I were a successful trader in corn, for example, a policeman would come to me and say, I want 30% of your daily take. And to make the point, he would take me to a nearby sort of informal camp, and he and his buddies would beat somebody to death in front of me. And they would say, this is what will happen to you unless I get my 30%. And that's how the police is funded to a major extent in the country. But it's more than just a soprano state. There is real national pride in North Korea. There's a limited amount of information that the citizens have. They know that their country is surrounded. They're taught that their country is surrounded by enemies. Japan, historical enemy. South Korea, which is the running dog of the United States. And the United States, which the lesson of the Korean War is that the United States is very dangerous. Very dangerous country indeed. And people are afraid of the United States, and they're taught to hate it, and they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. You're working on a new book, I understand.
Right.
And let's tell us what that is, what your topic is. It's about North Korea. And you get at this question of why are the North Koreans so angry?
Yeah. Well, I think for Americans trying to get their heads around the behavior of North Korea, there was a period the spring of this year where North Korea was threatening to nuke Austin, Texas, and Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
It just seemed crazy, sort of nutty, comical almost. But there's one thing that Americans should remember when they think about North Korea is the North Koreans' one encounter with the United States, one meaningful encounter, was the Korean War, 1950 to 1953. It was started when Kim Il-sung, the then leader of North Korea, invaded South Korea, and the United States was militarily embarrassed for a few months because they didn't have enough troops there. But very quickly, they got a huge number of bombers into the country. And over the next 3 years, the United States bombed North Korea nearly every day. They bombed so much that they destroyed every population center in the country, medium, small, and large. They bombed so much there was nothing left to bomb, and they killed maybe 1.5 million people, 20% of the population of the country, by some estimates. It's very hard to find somebody in North Korea who doesn't have a grandma who was killed by an American bomb. So when the leadership of North Korea says that the United States is dangerous, everybody has a memory through their own family that supports that idea. And a lot of them really do fear the United States and are angry at it, in part because the country is closed and they think of the Korean War as though it ended last Thursday.
Yeah, it's a constant drumbeat. Just one more question on Korea before we move to the Columbia River. So how does this end? How does our story end, do you think, between the U.S. and North Korea and South Korea? Not in our lifetimes, I'm sure, but...
I think the soft landing would be for China to preside over economic change process similar to what China itself has done, which is top down, keep the Kim family perfectly happy in control, but build manufacturing centers taking advantage of the very low wages that are offered in North Korea so that they make real things, make real wages, and can buy real food. The biggest problem in the country in terms of human rights is hunger. A third of the country is chronically malnourished. That percentage of the population is stunted from malnutrition, and cognitive impairment is also a very significant problem for now two generations of North Koreans. So if you can do that, you can solve the biggest problem in the country.
Shin, who we've spoken of before, how tall is he?
He's about 5'5" He is stunted.
Yeah.
He is stunted. His arms are bowed from childhood labor, and his body is covered with scars from the torture in the camps.
Yeah.
And he is doing quite well now. He has become the single most famous North Korean human rights advocate. His testimony and this book were largely responsible for the UN deciding to investigate human rights crimes in North Korea. Those hearings started last week, and they'll probably result in indictments to be presented at The Hague against the Kim leadership over time. So he has become a very important spokesman for human rights.
This is After Deadline. I'm talking with Blaine Harden, veteran journalist. We've been talking about Escape from Camp 14, and now we're going to turn to a book that you wrote in 1996, I believe, or was published in 1996, and the title was A River Lost, and it was about the Columbia River. Now you've updated the book, and it offers a somewhat different perspective. In your preface, you write, in the past 15, I should back up and just say that when I bought this book years ago, I was literally afraid of it because I knew what you were getting at. and I knew the story to some extent, but I really didn't want to know too much more than that. But you've reissued it, and in your preface you write, in the past 15 years, as the United States has stumbled into an era of climate change, soaring energy prices, debt-crippled governments, and global food scarcity, the mechanized Columbia has become more valuable, perhaps even more virtuous than ever before. Rather a startling statement, true, I think, but it's a perspective I don't think we necessarily talk about out here.
Well, I think the most important thing simply is hydroelectricity. The Pacific Northwest is blessed in that it gets a larger percentage of its total power from hydro than any other place in North America. Fantastic, except for British Columbia, actually. So as energy prices go up, the worry about global warming increases. The fact that this is green energy, and there's lots of it, is just a wonderful blessing for those of us who live in the Pacific Northwest. And what's also happened that I think is good news is that the Machine River, this plumbing system that the Columbia has become because of all the big dams, is better understood because biologists, fish biologists, and I'm talking about the health of the salmon runs in the Columbia and the snake system. Fish biologists have had now more than a half century to study how this machine works and how it can be better manipulated to suit the survival of salmon. Mm-hmm. And they've come up with a couple of things, actually one thing, that works much better than they thought would work, and that is to spill water over the dams at those times of year when salmon need to move downstream quickly. And they've started to do this with the support of federal judges who override everybody else and say, let's operate the river as the biologists say we should. And that has resulted in a very hopeful recovery in some of the salmon runs. It may be related to ocean conditions, but most fish scientists believe that they have done much better in keeping these salmon from going extinct than they thought possible 20 years ago.
And then you also refer, of course, to the reclamation aspect, which is what Grand Coulee was largely about initially, per Franklin D. Roosevelt, that also plays a role with climate change.
It's more valuable. The Eastern Washington, where the Columbia Basin Project is getting hotter. And it was already pretty darn dry. But there is a lot of water available through the irrigation system, and that water is going to be there for growing stuff, growing food. And there probably will be a greater need for the food that's grown there than there was 20 years ago, when people were saying the water would be much more valuable left in the river to make electricity and to keep salmon healthy. And in fact, that's probably still the case.
And in our last minute, you grew up out here. You grew up, your father worked on Grand Coulee Dam.
Yeah, my father worked at Grand Coulee. He worked at Wanapum. I worked at Grand Coulee when I was in college and the third powerhouse project was expanded. I was fired, I might add, for being a smartass. But I did work there. But no, most of the work I've done about the dam is to write about it.
So you got into journalism how? You went to college somewhere?
I was at Gonzaga University, and I tried out for the local paper, and I liked writing.
And then you found your way eventually to the Washington Post.
Yes.
Which was your home for how many years?
For 28 years at the Washington Post, 4 years at the New York Times. And then I left 3 years ago to start writing books for a living, and that's what I'm doing now.
And you live in Seattle?
I live in Seattle.
Great. Well, welcome. I'm saying welcome to our region. You've been here a while, but this is your sort of first trip to Astoria, maybe.
I've come to Astoria many times. I lived in Aberdeen. I went to high school in Aberdeen.
Oh.
And I used to come to Astoria when Astoria was a much poorer, down-on-its-luck town. It looks very good now.
Yeah. Well, with that, we'll thank Blaine Harden for joining us today. Blaine Harden is the author of Escape from Camp 14. And this is After Deadline. We're a joint production of The Daily Historian and Coast Community Radio. And our sound engineer is Richard Ridgway.